Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Hi there, everyone. I'm Lori Davis, and you're listening to The Lori Davis Show here on Blog Talk Radio this beautiful afternoon in the Great Northwest. And today, our special guest, Carrie Gladue. I'm going to have to ask Carrie if that's the right pronunciation of his last name. I think that's how you say it. But anyway, on Thursday, featuring Native Talk today, my special guest, I'm excited. I'm just dying to talk to him and can't wait to hear him share his journey and his story. And he is the author of a book called Second Chances, and he'll be telling us how we can get that. He will be sharing his incredible story of triumph over major events he endured in his lifetime. And these horrific setbacks put him on a path of addictions, trouble with the law, and a whole lot more, I'm sure. Today, Carrie works to help others and has shared his incredible story, as I said earlier, in his book, Second Chances. So I see that he's arrived, and I'm just going to take a moment here to welcome you to the show, Carrie. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm excellent. Now, the first thing I need to know is, how do you pronounce your last name correctly?
Gladue. I pronounce Gladue. Some Gladue. There's a few ways, but I'm comfortable with that. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much, because I believe names are really important, and I never like to mess that up. So thank you so much for joining us today. I know you're a busy guy, and it's a pleasure to have you with us. So I think the first order of the day, you were going to actually maybe share a little excerpt from your book. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. I'd like to do that.
I would love for you to do that.
Okay, I'll get started.
And you're just a little, volume is just a little low, so maybe get closer to your device or however you're coming in with us.
Is that better?
That is much better, thank you.
Okay. So here we'll start one of my chapters of my book.
Okay.
It's very hard for me to write this book. I'll get into that later.
Yes.
The physical abuse only got worse as time passed. We lived in a pretty tight-knit community, with our house being right straight across the street from my elementary school. I enjoyed singing and play acting from television shows I watched and pretended I was one of those characters. It really brought me away from what was going on around home and instilled some dreams for my future. There were many visits from the police and ambulances at my house, which were noticeable to my classmates and teachers. I'd get picked on and spend a lot of time defending my brothers and sisters. I used to be nicknamed Wagon Burner or a Dirty Indian. I was very hurt and unable to make any friends. My self-esteem was non-existent. I spent most of my elementary school days with my brother, skipping school and not coming home until late in the evening. I became a pretty good fighter, and I was known for that in my neighborhood. I'd be picked on and bullied enough so something had to give. The fighting at home was heartbreaking and more severe. I recall my sister and brother and I being locked in the basement, which was nothing more than a mattress on a dirt floor with bricks falling out of the walls. We had heard Mom screaming to stop. She pleaded, saying, "You're going to kill me." At this point, we were fighting to break out of the tiny basement window to try to get help for her. We heard glass smashing and then some silence. We made it out of the window and to the front street. The smashing of the glass was my mom jumping right through the glass window. She was completely naked and blood was coming out of everywhere on her. He had beaten her with a metal pipe from a vacuum. We made it down the block and banged on the people's doors to help us. This was also midwinter, very cold out. None of us kids had anything on but our pajamas. Mom was totally naked and wouldn't stop bleeding. We finally were let in by family. An ambulance was immediately called for Mom, and his kids were given a snack and allowed to sleep. I remember that this went on for what seemed like forever. And I'd like to stop there.
Wow.
Yes.
That is.
This book,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Carrie. Go ahead.
It's just it's a lot of stuff, a lot of stories I put in into writing this. This book you can be purchased through my Facebook page called Second Chances Carrie Gladue, or you mm-hmm. can email me at carriegladue@gmail.com if you need any other direction on how to get it. Thank you for that. It's always hard to read back on it and to go through it. But I'm smudging right now and things are good.
That's good. Well, that's why I like to do it right away and get it done. And I think it's very inspiring for people to hear the author actually share their own words. It's really powerful. And it supports in your story. I'm sure our listeners are making many connections as a result. So that's healing for them too, Carrie. So thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you. Thank you.
You're welcome. So let's talk a bit about what you do today. What are you doing right now besides, of course, being an author and getting your book out there? Let's talk a little bit about your life today.
Well, today I'm over 9.5 years clean and sober. I work in addictions. I'm a counselor and I'm an intake coordinator in a treatment center here in Calgary. So I really get an opportunity to share some of my experience and help people that are ready to heal get into treatment, right? Mm-hmm. And actually work in the place that I healed myself. So, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I'm also a father. I got a little 3-year-old daughter married to my beautiful wife, Shannon, who works in a treatment center for women and children. It's the only treatment center that will take a mom and her baby or babies that want help, right? Because a lot of moms can't get help because they're scared to leave their children, right? So this center actually takes them all as a family. So also part of my book proceeds go to support that center and the center that I work at as well, right? And I've paid special attention to the treatment center Elko because I know my mom could have used that when we were younger.
Yes.
And she would have supported that, right? So it's really dear to my heart.
Yes. Absolutely. That's great. And what are the names of the centers again?
Simon House Recovery Center is where I work.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And my wife works at Alcove Recovery Center for Women.
Okay.
Located in Calgary.
Okay. Well, I'm just jotting that down because oftentimes there are opportunities, you know, to raise funds or do a fundraiser, or I know people that would contribute. So thank you for that.
Oh, absolutely. That'd be so great. Thank you.
So what I know you, it might have been your, this might sound like a crazy question, but who or what, or what was it that inspired you to put your story in print? What motivated you to do that?
Yeah, well, I remember, like, I've been in and out of jail since I was a kid, right? You know, 30-something years in active addiction, prison, on the streets, and going to jail, I always noticed that we were, all of us inmates, we're all looking for some hope. We'd go look for reading material to pass time, to make us feel like there's something else, maybe we got a chance, and we're always looking for stories and books like that, but there wasn't much in there, right?
Mm-hmm.
For this day and age, with the addiction issues that go on today, the fentanyl, the crystal meth, stuff like that, right? And and I remembered that. I remembered that. And then later on in my journey of recovery, about 5 years into it, I started, you know, people started coming to me and telling me after they heard my story, the how it inspired them to come forward and that some of them are sober to this day and clean, right? Just by getting that out, because, you know, secrets keep you sick, right? And
yes.
It kept me sick for so many years.
Yes.
And I decided, you know, I'm going to put this, see what I can do with it. It's not something I planned on in the beginning, but I just I took some time to put this together. It's one of the hardest things I've ever done, Lori. I tell you, you know, I had to go through all of this. I had to do research. I had to go back to these old places where I was sexually abused, you know, all of this stuff. And it was hard, but it was also very healing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I put that all in my book, word for word. And if someone's reading my book, you're going to know that I'm going to be there with you because I wrote it like that. So you'll feel me there with you.
Oh, wow.
I've got overwhelming support on it, and it's been really good.
Oh,
and
great.
I'm thankful that it's helping people to this
right.
day.
Right. Excellent. Well, we all know what's, going on in our communities. It's hard to sit back and watch that, I know. But perhaps you could share, maybe go back to the beginning of how you ended up out of your home and in the system. I believe you started out in the system.
Yeah. Yeah, my first, I remember 7 years old, a lot of alcohol and drugs going on. My mom was raised in a residential school in Goulard, Alberta, since she was 15 months old. And she never knew any family at that time or anybody, right? And it was really saddening reading, in the research in my book, what that stuff's included too, is, she had nobody. And it talked about all her abuse. And it gave me an understanding of up to when I was 7 years old, when it started, that she had three little kids trying to raise with no education, no skills, and
mm-hmm.
trying to make a go for us, right?
Yeah.
And I ended up in foster home, me and my brother, a lot. 7 years old, I remember waking up in a line full of old beds, and there's little kids everywhere. And, I peed my pants. I was so scared, right? And that was the start.
Mm-hmm.
From then on,
mm-hmm.
until, I was 41 years old when it all ended for me, 12 years old, I'm taken again. No, 9 years old, I'm taken again for 3 years. And I wasn't allowed to see any of my family at all. And I thought my mom had passed away because all the beating she used to get from her spouse, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when I got brought home, he was finally gone out of the picture. All this stuff's in the book, of course. But then I was taken again, and I was apprehended in Edmonton, and I was told I'd be gone for 2 weeks, and I was going to a safe place by the social worker. And when I got to that house, I was, after a short time, I was sexually abused by the worker, and
mm-hmm.
Told if I told anybody my words, because of who I am and my background, no one would believe me. They'd believe him. And
mm-hmm.
I kept those secrets with me, and my addiction skyrocketed. I was into everything after that.
Mm-hmm.
Questioning my whole life. I had a secret I never want anyone to know. And all in the end, I was just, when I finally woke up, I realized I was only protecting the guy that did that.
Right.
27 years old. Yeah, 27 years old, Laurie, I walked into a police station after my own son being apprehended. All that stuff that I blocked out came right there, like I was that little boy again.
Oh,
and I
wow.
walked in a cold winter. I walked into a beat office in Edmonton, and I told them my story. And I tried to walk out the door, and the desk sergeant told me, you need to come and talk to us. It's a little more serious, right? So they found that person working in a center with a whole bunch of boys.
Oh.
And they arrested him. And I didn't know that this was all happening to all the other boys in the house I was at.
Mm-hmm.
One of my friends had hung himself over it too, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So dealing with that and coming forward was another hard thing for me to do. Because,
mm-hmm.
bringing up all that stuff and going to court and testifying and fixing that issue. Well, not fixing it, but dealing with that issue,
mm-hmm.
Again, I never got any counseling for it. I never did anything about it. And then I started getting worse into the drugs. I was overdosing.
Mm-hmm.
My mom and brother found me hanging in the basement once. Stuff
yeah.
I couldn't tell them either, right? Because it was such a deep secret of what was going on in my life.
Mm-hmm.
Relationship problems. I couldn't keep a relationship. know, I still struggle with stuff today. There's stuff that never goes away, really, right? I never healed from that.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I use my story not to promote change and hope. And, you know, I'll tell you, if I can do it from where I come from, anybody can do it. And there's a way to do it. Just take some patience and some time, right? And some good support and of all trust. You know, for us survivors, you know, trust is a big thing. We don't trust anybody.
No, you know, not after that experience.
Why would you?
No.
You know.
Yeah.
No, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know for my own self, I was also, I'm also a survivor, and it was a family member, and I was 12 at the time. And I never told anybody till I was 45. Imagine.
No.
And
yeah,
I didn't realize for many years, Carrie, that I didn't do the drugs or the alcohol, but I did other things that were just as damaging. I became extremely controlling. I was a perfectionist. I was afraid that people would judge everything about me, how I looked, how I dressed. I was an overachiever. These were my drugs. And believe it or not, they did as much damage as if I had just taken drugs and drank alcohol. Because for sure. Because the energy that all takes, heck, I could have had another business on the side with the energy that all took. Just to keep covering up the shame, because the shame wrapped around it was what I was trying to hide. So I hid behind the good look thing, the perfectionist thing.
Yeah.
And it was just, it just about took me out. And I know that for sure, you and I both know this. I'm not telling you anything, but you know what I'm talking about. But it's generally somebody that knows the family or is a family member, or because they already have a trust with us and they can use that to take that power over us and then threaten us. I was threatened. If you tell anybody, like, I'll burn your house down or I'll kill your mother, or right?
Yeah.
So yeah, we can't go to anybody. Mm-hmm.
No. Mm-hmm. No, and when you're young like that, too, who do you go to? You know, the people you're supposed to trust, right?
Right.
And mine would tell me that the one that did the social work that did that to me would tell me, you know, like it says, who are they going to believe, right?
Yes.
And at that time, when you're a little boy, of course, who are you going to believe? Here I am going through all this stuff, and you're a social worker, and you're helping all these kids, and
mm-hmm.
It's crazy. But, you know, on another note, this person that did that to me, this was in 1983, the investigation, he had convictions going back to the 1950s for molesting children, and he was still working in the field, right?
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
How much of that's going on? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, nothing like putting yourself in the place where, you know, easy access, right? So school teachers, bus drivers, I'm not accusing them, but you know what I'm saying? You put yourself places where you can access the kids, maybe a baseball coach, who knows?
Yeah, you never know. And like you said, it's not everyone's like that, but, you know, I think those people need to be, the baseball, all the coaches, all that, they need to be more observant of their peers too, right? You know, of what's going on, and better screening and whatnot, right? Because, like the 1950s, come on. And you're, how many years? 1950s to 83, and you're doing it, and it's still 1997, you're still doing it, right? So,
yeah, imagine,
Whew. Yeah.
Wowzers. So what was it that you feel was your turning point? What was it that you feel motivated that when you all of a sudden said, okay, I'm 41, enough already? Was there some incident or spiritual experience or that turned that around for you?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Thank you for asking that, because it was incredible. I was, My mom had passed away in 2008. She called me one day and said, "Son, you need to come home." And at that time, I was surrounded by the police, and I wasn't sure I was getting away, but I did. And I made it home. And it was, you know, when somebody calls, there's a death, you hear on the phone, you can see somebody saying, "What's going on?" And you know, it's a serious call, right? Something serious when a family member calls you. So my mom called me, "You got to come home." So I called, came home, and I went, sat on the front steps with her. She goes, "You know, I've been really sick." I said, "Yeah, I know. What's the matter?" She goes, "Son, I got 2 months to live. I got cancer, right?" And I didn't believe her at first. And the next day, she had surgery to remove a kidney. They were trying to remove organs to prolong her life. And I was such a mess, right? I couldn't believe the only person in my life that I loved was going, right? And when she passed away, shortly after that, my baby sister died of an overdose 2 blocks from our house. She was found deceased. And she was just young too, right? So it was just me and my brother left now, right? And then there's me. I'm on a suicide mission now. I don't care. I'm going to go see mom right away. I'm going to join her. You know, I was ODing. I was taking so much drugs that most people didn't want to be around me because I was such in bad shape, right?
Right.
But, you know, they knew what I was trying to do, right? And I finally, one day, I turned myself into the police station, and you know, I was 145 pounds. I walked into Edmonton Police Headquarters, downtown Edmonton, and said, "Here I am." And the rest was history, right? I picked up close to 300 charges across the province of Alberta I was running from. And I ended up in the remand center in Calgary on some of them. And then I went down to see my, I got called down to see my lawyer, and I was so sick. I was in my cell for like a week. I couldn't come out. I was never detoxed for how many years. You know, I've been doing hardcore meth and anything I can get my hands on. And I come upstairs and, or downstairs and visits, and the lawyer says, I said, "What am I looking at?" He says, "You're looking at 11 years right now." I said, "You got to be kidding." He says, "Nope." He says, "I've never sat in the courtroom that long just to read charges." So I said, "Well, thank you for making me feel better." And I went up to my cell. And I went into my cell, and I opened up a Bible. That's what happened. And I'm not a religious person at all, right? I just needed something. And I opened up, and it said, "If you pray with all your heart and soul," that's what I seen anyway, "I'll answer you." And that's what I did. I just started praying, and I started crying. And said, "Whatever happens, Creator, you know, just save me and take away this feeling." I was grieving my mom. I was grieving my sister. I couldn't get a hold of my brother. I was missing my kids. Everything hit me just at once. I just wanted to die, right? And I started going to programs in there, and I applied for a program that I told I wouldn't be eligible because I had too many charges, was Calgary Drug Treatment Court. So I applied for it, and after some time, I got accepted. And I got released treatment. Yeah, it's a court program. For anyone that's been in the system, you know, for that long and visit courtrooms and been arrested and all that, you know what courtroom's about. But this was a whole different courtroom, right? It was stern. But there was a lot of release conditions, right? Drug test twice a week, lots of monitoring. You're sent to a treatment center to do the treatment. And I was sent to Simon House, right? And I went there, and I went through all of that. But it was that feeling of a loneliness, I guess. And, you know, with my mom dying, my sister dying, it came to the reality that, you know, this can happen to, this doesn't just happen to anybody. You know, I'm not any better than anybody. I'm not invincible. And I'm pretty well next, too, if I keep this up, right? So I decided to, I'm going to do something different this time. I'm going to start trusting. I'm going to start looking at things different. I'm going to be more patient, and I'm going to start dealing with the stuff that's been keeping me sick. And that's what I did.
Wow.
That's exactly what I did.
Well, I guess because there was a bigger job for you and it wasn't time for you to go.
I guess, hey, yeah.
Well, a lot of times that's, right? The Creator has something in mind, and you know, we're just...
Yeah.
Just in the right place at the right time with the right people, to support us. Because for all intents and purposes, you shouldn't even be alive either.
No, not at all. You know, I've woke up in many ICUs, that's for sure. So, you know.
Well, this is very inspirational, and I'm very grateful that you're just willing to talk to me and talk to my listeners, because there are so many people. Our stories are the most empowering, rather than out of a textbook off the shelf, if you know what I mean.
I do, yeah.
And culturally, of course, we all learn best through storytelling. That's how we learn best. So, wow, that's awesome. So we know that there's still, I mean, that's been a while for you, 9 years, 10 years. And I'm wondering, this is just not meant to be a political question, but what do you think, just in your own observation, because you're working in the treatment center every day, in those 9 years, are we seeing any improvements or changes, or are things staying the same, or are they getting worse amongst our youth? What's your thoughts on that?
I think there's a lot more people reaching out for help these days. I think as far as there's a lot of the treatment centers and, you know, all over the place, you know, struggle financially. And a lot of these places are not for profit as well. They operate by donations. They do it just like what we're doing to help people. Right. And they still struggle to get a guy or a family in there or a child, whatever it is, that's ready at that time to get treatment. They've reached out and they can't get into treatment because of funding issues, no bed availabilities, long intake lists, stuff like that. Today I've noticed a significant change in that process as far as funding. The government's put out a lot of money into treatment, and this government has made a focus on doing that. And I'm ecstatic about that. I've seen a lot of different things over the, you know, I've worked in treatment about eight years now, I've seen that change gradually to now there's support, right? So can we use more? Of course, absolutely. Addiction isn't going away. We need to get the people in there when they're ready. You know, we have some great detoxes here in the province as well. And they do a great job, you know, of getting people ready for treatment. And when they call us, we need to be ready to accept them. We need to have, you know, a lot of these places need donations too. Clothing, you know, I know Simon House does clothing, winter stuff, you know, alcove as well, you know. There's
right.
Sunrise, there's a whole bunch of treatment centers, 1835, Fresh Start, South Country, all these places. And I've missed a lot. There's Past Two Place in Fort McMurray. All these places could use your support, right? Because addiction isn't for anybody. Anybody can get it. Doesn't matter where you come from. If you have money, if not, we've seen all kinds of people, professionals. It'll hit anybody, right? And we want to be ready when they're to come in. So, you know, my story is just one, Lori. One little story of thousands and thousands of stories of success. And as you mentioned, you know, of changes, we're seeing a lot of death with the fentanyl right now. Meth is going crazy again, crystal meth. You know, that stuff's all killers. And alcohol still is the number one killer as well, right?
Wow.
That's not talked about. So, if anyone can support these treatment centers, and not just my treatment center, any treatment center you see out there that's going out of their way to help people, because you know what, we may need them one day, and we will, and they'll be there and able to operate. So
that's correct.
Know, help your loved one.
Well, I also am of the theory that, and I'm all everything that you just shared, but I'm also interested in, and maybe that's because of the work I do, prevention. So if I always say to my clients, you know what, we're all just busy recovering from our childhood. Now, if we were able to make some changes about what that childhood looks like, then the diversion from having to have so many people on the other end, go for help. And that's where I would like to see lots of dollars spent and lots of money spent, is on the prevention side. Great parenting programs. And let's talk a little bit about that, because the residential school system impacted the ability for our people to parent effectively. So that whole, there's like a big hole there. You know what I mean? Like
oh,
you
for
said
sure.
Your mom,
oh, I agree.
Right? And they,
yep. Yep.
They missed out on all of that for not just one generation, but three or four or five now. So let's talk a little bit about that, how the residential school system itself has impacted what happened to you as a kid and what's happening to our children right now. Because a lot of people don't understand that.
No. You know, my mom was very loving, but very standoffish as well on things.
Okay.
And, you know, and she always did the best she can, and she always, you know, shy. She was also shy, but she standoffish, but also very, very, she'll stand up for anybody as well, right? You know, mm-hmm. I can only speak from my mom, and I know there are a lot of, it's probably all similar, you know, the things that she went through in there, the abuse, the sexual abuse, you know, the only thing she was shown is how to clean floors and stuff. That's it. And so, and that mm-hmm. was it. Right? So as far as for the intergenerational stuff that you talked about, I agree. I think we got to, with the families, yeah, we got to start, if we can get them out of the treatment centers, oh, I'm all for that. You know, I'm mm-hmm. hoping I can work with some youth here soon and be able to have an impact there in some way as well. You know, family programs, unfortunately, yeah, we're catching the back end of the intergenerational right now, but it's still mm-hmm. going on, right? Like you said, it's starting, it's right next door to us practically, and we can have more support for them, more funding as well, more interest, more participation.
Mm-hmm.
That would be great. That would be really
yeah.
great.
Well, I had a group of 10 youth, 16 to 18, that came to see me in Buck Lake here. I have a little retreat center here. Can't do anything right now because of COVID, but anyway, they were from the north, northern Saskatchewan. All 10 of them had been apprehended as infants, all 10 of them. And so I asked them three questions, you know, what you all were apprehended. I knew that. And then I said, how many of you have thought about taking your own life? All 10. 10 thought of it, 8 of them had a plan, and 6 out of the 10 had actually tried. I think our statistics are a little off. The third question
yeah.
was, have you ever been sexually assaulted? And guess what? All 10 had been sexually assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
One boy had been in 32 homes by the time he was 3. And I'm, you know, I'm going to put myself, my neck out there now. We'll get a little risque here, Carrie. So is my question is, and I've often said this to many people on reserve, chiefs, people that I'm connected with, said, so is the welfare system similar to residential school in some way?
Well, I just shared with you my story about
mm-hmm.
My apprehension. Is it?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
No. Is it? Yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah.
Because it's separation of family, isn't it? I mean.
Yeah.
They're separated
no
from their family. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's no different. No different at all.
I don't think so. The circumstances are the same.
Yeah.
But, you know, that
yeah,
doesn't mean that
question.
Some of our kids don't land in good homes, but, you know, that,
oh, for
that
sure.
whole
yeah.
apprehension thing and welfare system and, yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And then you're right, too. Like, there's, you know, there's some good homes kids end up in, and it's needed, too, but I don't think it's managed properly at all, or I don't think the
mm-hmm.
care is there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
to be honest with you.
Yeah. And even not being able to keep our kids in their community and maybe be in the care of someone else, a relative or a sister, but they're still at least in the community and they have family, they have kin.
Yeah.
I think that makes a difference too. So,
yeah,
all right.
Totally.
Yeah, for sure. So tell us a little bit about how long were you actually in jail, being incarcerated? How was that for you?
Well, this last time I was in there for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually getting ready to go to the pen, right? So to do my start my 11, so I would have done about 7 years. It was rough for me because, you know, I was on the streets. I was, you know, doing anything I can. I had police always watching me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was feeding my addiction. That's all it was. I wasn't trying to be a millionaire. I was trying to feed my addiction. I always had this
mm-hmm.
pain. If I woke up and I had no drugs, I'd start feeling again. I'd start
mm-hmm.
feeling all this stuff again. And the drugs and the alcohol was the only thing that would take that away. And if it ran out, I knew my nightmare was coming again.
Mm-hmm.
So I did whatever it took to feed that.
Yes.
And that's been the majority of my life. And, you know, being someone that's been in jail lots, it's a very similar story to a lot of people in there, right? That
mm-hmm.
have gone through the same thing. And I just got tired of it. And I thought, if other people can do it, why can't I?
There you go.
It makes me so different that I can't get better, have a better life, not
mm-hmm.
have chaos, anxiety, not worrying about my next meal,
mm-hmm.
what I'm going to wear, you know, all that stuff, life stuff, you know, everyday stuff that people take for granted. That's all I wanted.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And don't you think, Carrie, most importantly, your safety, being safe, feeling safe?
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had the same phone number since I sobered up. A lot of people laugh at that, but
for an
addict or somebody or someone on the street, you know, if you got anybody there listening, the listeners, they know exactly what I'm talking about. I've had the same number since I sobered up, 9.5 years. I couldn't keep a cell phone number for 2 weeks before if I can get a pay-to-go phone. I had no credit. I couldn't get a phone from anywhere, right?
Right,
you know, but
right.
Little things like that, right? You know, I have a home. I have a beautiful wife. I got a job. I don't worry about the little things anymore, but I do worry about others, though, right? You know, I like people. I think the reason why I do this and I feel in my heart, you know, I want people to come over here, see, check it out, know that they can do it too.
Yes.
They can do it too, right? And there's support.
Absolutely.
You know, I received so many calls from people to say.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead, sorry.
Yeah. No, I was just going to say, you were right on track anyway, but just, you know, right now, and you just said something big, if I can do it, you can do it. So let's talk a little bit about some words of encouragement you'd be giving right now if there were 1,000 youth sitting in front of you and you were speaking to them and they wanted to hear words of encouragement. What are some things you would say? And you've said a big one already. If I can do it, you can do it.
Okay.
So what else would you say?
I'm going to share one. It's not mine, but I use it when I'm talking at, you know, I go talk in correctional facilities and schools
Perfect.
And stuff like that. When pre-COVID, of course, hopefully I'll be getting back to that soon. But I would like to say this, you know, when I went to jail, I had so many friends on the street, so to speak. Everybody wants something from me. You know, I'm doing crime. I got drugs, whatever, right? But when I went to jail, I didn't even have 2 cents in my account to make a phone call. Nobody was there. I had one of my
mm-hmm.
friends, you know, would put in a couple bucks here for canteen, but 6 months I had nothing. I had no
mm-hmm.
money to make phone calls to my family. Those were my bros. Where were my bros and all the people when I was sitting in there? Well, you know where they went? They moved on to the next people.
Oh.
That's what happened. And I have this thing that it's not mine, but I like to read it
absolutely
to you.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Show me your friends and I'll show you your future. And that's very powerful to me. Show me your friends and I'll show you your future. I hang out with some pretty amazing people today, healthy people, and that helps me stay healthy. You know, I've come to the understanding that and a hard lesson on where I need to be and who I need to be socializing with. I can't be around chaos and stuff anymore. I get that sick feeling and I remove myself from it. I need to protect my sobriety. Sobriety comes first before anything, right? If I don't have my sobriety, I don't have my family, I don't have my career, I ain't talking to you on the phone, Lori. Right?
Yeah.
Things are a lot different. And I'm probably dead on the street, right? So I keep that protected as much. Am I a perfect guy? No, I make mistakes now and then too, right? But, you know, I try my best to make amends and own them right away. I don't put things off. I have to tell you, if I was speaking to the youth, I'd tell them, you know, if you're struggling, reach out. Reach out to someone you trust. Take that chance. You'll be surprised at what you'll hear coming back. Because I never did that. If I would have done that years before that, I would have had a lot more good years left in me, right? I've not wasted so much time in that kind of life and that much pain.
Absolutely. Well, there's another way of saying that I read years ago, too. You become what you are around.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep. Well, pretty much the same thing, yeah. Absolutely.
Same thing, right? Yeah, you bet.
Same thing, yeah.
And
I like that.
And the thing about protecting your sobriety, I love that because when you realize the hard work that it took and the journey that it took for you to get there, that was a lot of work. And so it's important that we protect any work that we do on ourselves because it's not easy. And to allow someone else to steal that from you now, and that's basically what people are doing when they're trying to make us feel badly about ourselves or encourage us to do something that's not supportive. They're basically stealing from us.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with
and,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I worked really
yourself.
Hard
that's
to, to rebuild myself. And I can't be around people who are going to try and break it down either. It makes you, like you said, I love that. You feel sick to your stomach, right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just a nauseous feeling. And you know it right away, eh? You know right away that it's coming. So no. Yeah. And, you know, I trust, you know, I've trusted my gut instincts on a lot of stuff and on judgments and with, you know, and I knew what I was getting into back in the day too with where I was. I knew, you know, but that's where I was comfortable. That's where I was comfortable, right? And if there was any sign, reverse that. If I was around healthy people, I'd feel nauseous back then too.
Yes.
Right? Because I'm sick.
That's right.
Right?
Yeah.
So you'll notice the change once you start getting that feeling that this ain't right. I'm not comfortable here. There's something going on. I'm going to remove myself from this situation. And little by little, you'll do it naturally. You won't even know you're doing it, right?
That's right. Yeah, when that one gets bigger than the other, right? So let's have a little talk. I'd love to have your feedback and your opinion perhaps on, and this is just coming up for me as we're talking, so just off the cuff. There's a lot of gang activity on in our communities. What have you got to say about that? Why do kids join gangs?
Connection, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Connection to be with somebody. Family, you know, a lot of people, like we talk about the families, right? A lot of families are not connected or separated for all different kind of reasons, intergenerational stuff, and they're looking for a connection and love, you know. Just because they're in the gang doesn't mean, you know, they are just looking for that kind of bonding from their brothers, right? I talk about in my book, one of my friends I grew up with started a gang, one of the biggest gangs in Canada. And And he left the gang life, and he went on to start helping youth in that to get out of gangs, and that's another powerful thing too. His name is Sean. I like to mention him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's it. It's connection. Everybody, you know, I've never been in a gang. I steered away from it, to be honest with you. I had my own stuff going on, actually. But I do know a lot of people that were in gangs, and that had to be the biggest thing that offhand, without having any experience, would be the connection.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
It's their family. Yeah. It's their family.
It's their family. Yes. Yeah. And of course,
and why did they need a family?
Them.
Because they. Well, yeah, and why do they need a family? Because they don't have one anymore. Their family's been disconnected.
Mm-hmm.
They're just looking for love. They're looking for love.
Yes. Totally. Yeah. So there's lots of layers of, you know, the violence, the abuse, the suicide, and then the you know, another maybe point we could talk about is the poverty. The people are living in such poverty. And, you know, if you're in mainstream, you're looking at the news and you're reading the paper and you say, oh my gosh, all these Native people getting all this money. Let's talk about the money, because nobody wants to talk about that, you know. But oftentimes it doesn't land in the hands of the people.
No, yeah. I don't know too much about the money part. But for I'm working at, you know, a lot of people don't have any money, right? Indigenous or non-Indigenous. They're, you know, it's whatever they can get, they're using it to numb the pain. There's some stats done, I think, I forget who I heard it through, and I don't want to quote it, but the person, but it was like 75-80% of men in treatment center have been sexually abused, right? That's pretty high, right? That's pretty high.
Absolutely.
And being someone that works in treatment and as a counselor, I back that up fully.
Yes.
You know, let's talk about the moms as well and the children, right? It's probably higher, right? So what are they doing? They're numbing the pain. Do they want to provide for their families? Do they want to raise their children? Damn right they do. You know? Just because we're addicts, and that doesn't mean we don't have love and we don't care for our babies. You know, just because we went through residential school or we're second generation survivors, it's not that we never loved our family or our babies at all. It's just that, you know, for me, I didn't know how to raise my kids at all. I didn't have that connection with love. That wasn't passed on to me.
That's right.
You know, the care, the skills, it wasn't passed on to me at all. I wasn't trained. You know, I was trained to survive by any means, to hide my emotions or they'll get me in trouble, to show my emotions because it'll show a sign of weakness for what kind of life I'm living to others. And, you know, to get as much any money I can to hide and numb the feelings I was going through, the guilt, shame, and remorse, right?
Yes.
And we know it's all a downhill spiral from there. You know, never in the history of addiction and alcohol or drugs have you ever heard of it getting better. It always gets worse, right?
Yes. Well, I know from my own experience and the work I do too, my women who have been sexually assaulted, that, you know, the pain is there. And I don't know, you may disagree with me on this, and that's quite okay. But for my guys, for men who've been sexually assaulted, it's like there's this extra layer of hurt because there's this deal, you know, that men are supposed to be able to take care of themselves. What do you think about that?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that again? That just...
Or, well, you know, like when women are sexually assaulted, the hurt is there, the shame is there. But I don't know, I get the feeling when I'm working with my men that when it's them, there's like this extra layer of shame, extra layer of hurt, because men traditionally are supposed to be able to take care of themselves, even little boys. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's right there. You know, you got this mentality that you're the head of the family, you're the head of things, you're a man.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, I think that was the answer right there, really.
You know,
it doesn't happen to men. It's not something that was talked about widely a lot more now, right? Of course. But you know, years back, nobody talked about it. Nobody mm-hmm. brought it up. Nobody was ever going to say, you know, you're sexually abused or sexually assaulted at all, right? Because then there's such stigma about it as well, right?
Absolutely.
I used to think, you know, one of my concerns was, okay, this happened to me by a male. Am I, you know, is there something wrong with my sexuality now? Am I going to be different? You know, all this stuff, right? You get into relationships and you always try to have, you know, the right prettiest girl around you so everybody can see that, you know,
that
you're with a girl, you know. Meanwhile, they don't know what's going on anyway, but it's just in your own head, right? You're trying to cover this all up to make yourself feel better. But, yeah.
Well, that's another whole show, Carrie.
It is, yeah.
So as we get a bit closer to our time here now, I'm just going to ask you one more question, and then I'll wrap things up. And I just want to let you know how grateful I am to have you here with me today. And we're going to have a lot of people listen to this show, and I'm really glad about that, because it's timely and it's inspiring and it's brought hope to others. I know that hearing your story. So I just want to thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you so
Not
much.
Not everybody's
for
willing
really
to talk about it, you know.
Yeah. Well, hopefully that'll change. You know, it's safe to do so now, you know. It's safe to talk about it now. It's not, you know, and they're not alone.
There you go. There's a big one right there, hey?
Not alone, no.
All right. Yeah. So just in closing, I want you to have the last say here. So just anything else that you would like to share with all of the people who are going to hear you on the show here today.
I'd like to just say thank you all for being here today. I love you all. Thank you for your interest in my story and my book. I wrote it from my heart to you in my own words to show you that it's okay and that you're not alone. I look forward to hearing from you again, and I look forward to talking to you again, Lori.
Well, thank you so much. And how about just another plug as to how people can get your book?
Thank you. So my book can be purchased on Second Chances Carrie Gladue. That's my Facebook page. There's a shop button on there. It's a link that'll take you right to that page. Yeah, just press the shop button. We also, if you can't do that, we can also take e-transfers to carriegladue@gmail.com. That's carriegladue@gmail.com. Just send me an email. I'll walk you through that. Postage is pretty quick right now. It's COVID too. Keep in mind, 7 days, sometimes 7-9 days, sometimes three or four. So I've had books are coming in. They're all signed copies. And remember, a portion of my book proceeds goes to help treatment centers to get people help and that they need. And you'd be playing a part in that. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. And we'll talk to you soon. I'm Lori Davis. You've been listening to The Lori Davis Show here on Blog Talk Radio. My guest today, Carrie Gladue, author of Second Chances, and a very inspiring guest and real and telling the story of what it's really all about. And it's time for us to come out of the shadows, I would say. I think that is the name of a book, Coming Out of the Shadows. And telling our stories, because that's what we need to hear to encourage us and inspire us all to know that life can be whatever we want it to be once we make a decision or we make different decisions. So thank you everyone for being here. Our show will be loaded up in about 5 minutes after we leave, And I load the show up on my Facebook page, The Laurie Davis Show, and then it can be shared from there. So I would encourage anybody who's listening today to make sure that we share the show. I'll be doing that with all my contacts tomorrow, and they can just click on there and listen to the show right off the Facebook page. So, and then we're good to go. So bye for now. Laurie Davis, you've been listening to The Laurie Davis Show here on Blog Talk Radio.